now.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Blueprint for Wealth, a program dedicated to securing your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. Now, here's your host, Wayne Zell.
Good morning and welcome to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, your host of this fast-paced half hour of special topics and special guests designed to help you realize your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman, always at your side. Located in Reston, Virginia, serving the entire Washington, D.C. metro area, with clients all across the country, OFP is your full-service law firm. Please visit us on the web at ofplaw.com for more information about the attorneys at the firm and the services that we offer. Also, I invite you to subscribe to my blog, blueprintforwealth.org, where you can get video, audios, including all of these old radio shows, and articles on tax, estate planning, and business planning topics of interest. And of course, today, getting near the end of the year, we're always interested in talking about tax planning strategies. And I know I've done it several times throughout the year, but hey, it's coming to the end of the fiscal cliff, and we might as well, hopefully, there will be no fiscal cliff that we fall off of. We'll see what Congress does for us. But in the meantime, let's talk about top tax strategies, assuming that the Bush tax cuts do, in fact, expire at the end of this year. That is the theme for my year-end tax planning for all my clients and for all of you listeners. The theme is uncertainty. And chief among the reasons are the sky-high exemptions on the estate tax, the lifetime gift tax, and generation skipping tax, which all are set to expire at the end of this year. All are currently set at $5.12 million for 2012, but they're headed for expiration at the end of the year. Most planners expect that these taxes and others, including taxes on capital gains and dividends, will be going up, way up, next year, though no one knows for sure. And that's the rub. The big question is whether the Bush-era tax cuts are going to expire at the end of 2012. Many expect Congress, in a lame duck session, to come through with some form of extension that will not cause all of the Bush tax cuts to expire. We just don't know what that's going to look like. Now, I've got a list of top strategies for you to think about before the end of the year. And these are strategies, again, that are based on the assumption that the Bush tax cuts may, in fact, expire. Number one on my list, particularly for those clients who have enough financial wealth to afford it, is considering the $5.12 million estate and lifetime giving tax exemptions. We may not see those in the near future for quite a while, as a matter of fact. For the rest of the year, beneficiaries of anybody who dies won't pay federal estate tax on the first $5 million of value of his or her estate. A gift tax and generation skipping tax exemption, both at $5.12 million, were designed to synchronize with the estate tax exemption. That means that before they die, our clients, you, can give up to $5.12 million to anyone, including grandchildren or charity, for without any limitation, without paying taxes on the money. For couples, the limit is over $10 million. With a 35% tax on assets above these thresholds. There's also a $13,000 annual gift tax exemption, which is scheduled to go up to, I believe, $14,000 next year. It remains in place and does not count against these $5 million thresholds. By next year, if Bush tax cuts expire, the exemptions will drop to $1 million for gift tax and estate tax, and about $1.32 million for the generation skipping transfer tax. Many of my clients have already taken advantage of these exemptions, but others think they pose hidden and dangerous risks. There are a number of things that we leave to our kids. They include family values, faith, and work ethic. But trading a tax savings for a work ethic, or at the expense of creating a trust fund baby, may be a good choice. Some of my clients have decided it's just not worth the risk to give money too soon to a child or a grandchild, even if the high giving threshold disappears next year. Of course, you can always place these assets in trust that are controlled by third parties, and the third parties can use their discretion as to whether or not any of these assets really ultimately end up in the hands of your kids or grandkids. Number two on my list is channeling estate transfers through and using family limited partnerships and limited liability companies. I've been advising my clients to combine the gift tax exemption with these types of vehicles. The partnerships or LLCs are a tool that you can use to give away a great deal of wealth, but remain in control of the underlying assets. One of my clients, for example, owned about $7 million in commercial real estate. By putting it into a family LLC, the actual value of the property was discounted to about $4.5 million through an appraisal process for tax purposes because it's not liquid, and any minority interest in that entity, in that limited liability company, is not marketable. The gift, therefore, fell under the $5 million gift tax threshold and was made tax-free. The giver can remain a general partner or a manager of the LLC, owning a small percentage, but keeping all the decision-making to himself or herself. The remainder of it can be owned by the child or a trust, better yet, for the benefit of the child. When the giver dies, the recipient may pay a capital gains tax on the difference between the tax basis of $4.5 million and any appreciation that is generated on the property. So if it appreciated to $10 million, who cares? They still got $7 million out of the estate, and the tax rate may be as high as 55% on that. Number three, open a donor-advised fund if you're charitably inclined. A donor-advised fund allows somebody to contribute any amount he or she wants to charity without having to name the charity right away. Once the money is in the fund, it's gifted from the perspective of the Internal Revenue Service. But the client can take his or her time deciding who will get the ultimate disposition of the funds. It gets the money out of the income tax column and buys time for you. Part of many people's identity, many of my clients' identities, are how closely tied they are to a specific charity or particular purpose. So even if they have a couple of bad years, they can keep up with their giving commitments if they've set aside funds in one of these donor-advised funds. Next on my list is using highly appreciated stocks, which there are still many, for charitable giving. Whenever possible, I urge my clients to give highly appreciated stocks instead of cash to fund charitable causes. It allows you to keep up with your giving, but avoid having to pay capital gains tax on your low basis cost investments. Next, and you've heard this hundreds of times, but I'll say it again, for certain people, a Roth IRA conversion does make sense. When it comes to contemplating this conversion, please proceed with extreme caution and have your accountant by your side when you do this. In the right cases, Roth conversions make sense. One example, let's say you have an executive who retired last year, but is not yet 70 and a half years old when you're required to take out distributions from your IRAs. For this year, he has no earned income and is not taking Social Security. His only income is capital gains. 10 years from now, however, he's going to be taking out six-figure distributions from his tax-deferred retirement accounts. So maybe he does a Roth conversion of $100,000 this year at the lowest state and federal rates, particularly when rates are lower this year than they may be in the future. He pays the taxes now, and the money that he's converted will grow tax deferred forever, meaning it's tax exempt after that. Another advantage of Roth conversions, by the way, is that Roth accounts are not burdened by mandatory distribution requirements. So when you hit age 70 and a half, you're not required to make distributions out of a Roth. Here's another idea. Direct your annual gift tax exemption of $13,000 this year to 529 college plans. I urge my clients to put annual tax-free gifts of $13,000 for each child or grandchild directly into a 529 account. These accounts allow tax-free accumulation of investments in savings accounts that are earmarked to pay for higher education or qualified college education expenses. They're wonderful. Another idea, investing in municipal bonds. This is going to be a hot topic. If dividend rates truly do rise from 15% to 43.4%, and interest rates can be taxed as high as 43.4% next year, many of our clients, many of you, are going to be investing heavily in municipal bonds, which will cause the bond market to shift and the pricing of bonds to change. So many people are actually starting to look at municipal bonds as alternative investments. For high net worth individuals, the tax-adjusted returns for municipal bonds can be superior to those on alternative fixed income interests, securities like treasury bonds. Also, invest in an independent film. Here's my last tidbit for today. Under Internal Revenue Code Section 181, you can take a write-off for investing in an independent film. It's really popular out in L.A. You can take the write-off as long as the total budget on the production is less than $15 million and as long as 75% of the film is produced in the United States. Now you know why there's no shortage of independent films debuting every year, even though fewer people are going to the movies. I'm Wayne Zell, and you're listening to Blueprint for Wealth, and those are some top tax planning ideas for 2012. Check with us at OF&P at 703-218-2100 for more help on these topics.
You're listening to Blueprint for Wealth with Wayne Zell. Learn how to better prepare for your future when Blueprint for Wealth returns in a moment.
A Legal Minute with Wayne Zell.
Many families struggle with the question of transferring ownership of a business to kids. The SBA estimates that only a third of all businesses are successfully transferred from one family member to another. Family businesses face at least four hurdles to successful transfer of control: lack of planning, unwillingness of the owner to transfer control, unwillingness of the kid to manage the business, and dwindling prospects for the business. Unless you can overcome these hurdles, the odds against a successful transfer are great. We advise for an owner to successfully transfer a business, you must carefully consider the following: strategic planning, knowledge of the family and its strengths and weaknesses, choosing a successor, and willingness to make succession work. Through careful succession planning, a business owner can successfully transfer control to the next generation. An experienced business attorney can assist you desiring to transfer your business to the next generation.
Welcome back to Blueprint for Wealth, a program dedicated to securing your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. If you have questions for Wayne, you can email him at radio@ofplaw.com or call him at 703-218-2100. Now back to your host, Wayne Zell.
Welcome back to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, and with me today is my special guest, who's a repeat guest, John Allen of Bluestone Capital. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Wayne.
John is one of the investment banking pioneers of the D.C. area. If you didn't know this, I'm telling you a little bit of his history. During his two decades in investment banking, he's helped build two highly successful firms that were acquired by other financial institutions and has been involved in more than 150 deals with and for Fortune 500 and middle market companies. It includes some of the biggest names in aerospace, defense, information technology, and professional and technical service sectors. Because of his success and thought leadership, one of my favorite terms, thought leadership, John has received many industry accolades, including Investment Banker of the Year honors from the Association for Corporate Growth. He's always interviewed on much more prolific radio shows than this one, but we're really, really very happy that he's decided to join us today. A little bit more background. He founded Bluestone Capital. When did you found that the firm?
Just a little over 2 years ago.
2 years ago, and things are going well for you now.
They're going very well, thank you.
Which is an amazing thing. He was a co-owner at Windsor Group, and then Windsor Group, of course, sold out to BB&T Capital, and John was there for many years and now is here. He's also on the boards of various charities, including Northern Virginia Family Service, Northern Virginia Tech Council, CIS Secure Computing, Iron Bow Technologies, et cetera. He's got a master's degree in business administration from AU and his bachelor's in political science from the University of Florida. John, how has uncertainty regarding the federal budget and sequestration impacted the merger and acquisition market for government contractors?
Well, there's no doubt it's had an impact. It's made everything, as you would expect, a lot harder. It certainly has not halted mergers and acquisitions. There's been a pretty steady state of activity for really the last 12 to 18 months. I think what it's done is it's raised the bar. It's made companies have to be a heck of a lot more prepared before they ever undertake the process of selling their business. I think, as also we've seen, however, it with uncertainty comes opportunity. We created Bluestone 2 years ago because we saw the market starting to change and we felt there was a need for a different kind of investment bank out there that had the experience through both an up and a down cycle. And we also saw back the last time the sector saw a declining budget environment, we saw a lot of companies emerge and assume leadership positions as a result of being very proactive in a market that was otherwise uncertain. Companies like Antion and Viridian, who really didn't exist until in the mid-90s and built themselves during that time when we had a declining budget environment. So
they took advantage of opportunities that were there.
Absolutely. It is not a time to rely on the status quo.
Well, you know, that's a great statement. You should trademark that. It's not a time to rely on the status quo, and it's true. Do you think sequestration is going to happen?
My gut tells me no. I've been around Washington now 20 years. I've seen a lot of these things that come, and you know, the world is going to come to an end, so to speak, and somehow miraculously at the 11th hour,
they
pull it out, and all the parties take credit for the solution. I certainly hope that's the case again.
So
I think, you know, the big difference here is it's been a very uncertain time for a long period of time as they've been trying to figure out a solution. But my gut tells me no. That's, you know, what my wife has certainly told me as I get anxious about all these things over the years. She always says, well, you get anxious, you come home, and then all of a sudden there's a solution at the 11th hour. So I'm going to rely on her gut.
Well, I like her thought process. I'm hopeful that they'll come to a solution in a lame duck session. I know they're, you know, convening already now to do that. My expectation is that they're not going to solve the world's problems by December 31st, but at least hopefully they'll come up with a framework for it.
Certainly. And look, you know, my view is if they wanted to show bipartisanship, right now might be the time to just simply say we're not going to let sequestration happen.
Right.
If it means we're going to have to extend the time frame until we get the new Congress in, until we get past all that. That's what you would do in the business world. So hopefully they would do something as common sense as that in the political world.
But they don't operate the government like a business.
Right. Very good point.
So anyway, we had a massive changeover in the Senate. I mean, the Democrats now have 55 seats instead of 51, but the Republicans basically maintain control of the House, and the president was reelected. How will the election results alter the merger and acquisition environment, in your view?
I think, you know, look, we have a sector, at least obviously we focus on the defense and government marketplace. So,
right.
So we can't comment. I'm not sure these comments would apply to the broader merger and acquisition environment, but we have a sector that has a lot of well-managed companies that have significant resources that are going to face growth challenges if they rely on organic growth activity. It is still a very big budget, no matter how you slice it, even if we see a downturn. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, businesses long and short of it, they want to grow. They want to continue to be successful. So I think, you know, while it might change in the swim lanes that buyers focus on will change over time, I think we'll continue to see a very active consolidating environment as we have in the past 12 to 18 months. And certainly, I can't imagine, we've had some of the most uncertain times the last year, right. And we're still seeing deals happen. I think with clarity, good, bad, or indifferent, clarity will help those even take more steps towards taking the plunge in the merger and acquisition arena.
Well, you talked about opportunity. What are some of the hot acquisition areas in federal marketplace and in the Department of Defense marketplace?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's a herd mentality, so you can see it pretty easy out there. I think it's things like mobility solutions, wireless. We've seen buyers like General Dynamics go out and make acquisitions in that area. Certainly for the health segment of the
Absolutely.
Of the sector has been very active from a consolidation standpoint, really for the last couple of years, and will continue to be.
Right.
Cyber is changing. The definition of what cyber is changing, and
how is it changing? What are you seeing?
I think not all things cyber will rewarded.
Work.
Right. And I think buyers are very discerning right now. So ultimately, you know, buyers can figure out what a company truly does when they get in to do their due diligence. But I think certain areas of cyber will continue to be active. I think big data is another area we're consistently hearing.
Data storage and data transmission.
And just managing the massive amounts of data that the government has to deal with each and every day.
I remember when my computer, my PC had... it was something like 280 megabytes of storage on it. And now, you know, if you don't have, a terabyte of storage, you don't have anything
right.
worthy of speaking about. So, yeah, big data is obviously something
right.
with video and audio and all the other types of content we have to manage. It really is important. Who are some of the most active people doing acquisitions in the federal and defense marketplace today?
Well, it's been a wide group of companies that have been active. Obviously, the larger players like General Dynamics, Raytheon, Lockheed, which just announced a transaction today, I believe.
Really?
Have been active. General Dynamics has probably been one of the most active amongst the larger players. But all, you know, by and large, most of the larger participants in the industry have remained active, you know, for years. I think that private equity has continued
Still.
To show interest in the sector, and that would be both new entrants, private equity groups that haven't historically been participants, who see it as a good buying opportunity,
right.
as well as the half a dozen or dozen legacy private equity groups that have focused on the defense and government marketplace.
Why are these companies continuing to buy, even in an uncertain environment involving an potential economic downturn and sequestration?
Right. Well, I think, you know, it's different by category. But if you look at the large players, you know, they know at the ground level, despite the broad uncertainty out there, they have a sense and have tremendous resources to understand at the ground level what are the priorities to the customer. And so their acquisition strategies are geared towards filling out capabilities that meet the pretty well-established and known priorities of the customer that presumably are going to be somewhat immune to broader cuts.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at that, that's the very strategic buyer, and they're not necessarily a value buyer. They're buying to maintain growth and leadership in key areas that are perceived to be key areas going forward. There are private equity groups that perceive it as a value opportunity right now.
Really?
Yes.
You know, you're seeing a lot of layoffs. You're hearing about a lot of rifts that are occurring at some of these bigger defense contractors. Yet you're saying that the M&A market is robust, and that's not what I'm hearing from other people who are out there in the marketplace. But I mean, your nose is right there, and so I want to be able to distinguish that statement a little bit for the listeners out there. You know. It's robust in the right areas is what you're saying.
Right. It's robust in the right areas, or if you have the right expectations and if you're well-positioned business. So there are a lot of transactions not happening today as
right.
well, probably more than usual.
Right. What could a seller expect in terms of valuations today using the metrics that investment bankers typically use?
Right. And well, You know, I think we are seeing more and more transactions that are of less specialized type businesses that are occurring, you know, at multiple of a 6x EBITDA, earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, or a metric of cash flow, if you will.
Okay.
You know, look, prior to the very good times, that was really the average valuation we were seeing. So
right.
if you go back to the mid-90s, into early, you know, 2000s, those,
right.
So we're seeing multiples today for a large set of companies that are very consistent with multiples we saw, you know, pre-9/11.
Okay. Which makes sense. So the valuations are adjusted downward compared to what they were in the last 5 or 6 years, but they're still fairly robust. I mean,
right.
Six times EBITDA is not so bad compared to some other industries, which only attract maybe a three or four multiple, right?
Right.
So,
right.
All right. So we've talked about valuations. We've talked about opportunities. What are the impediments to completing an M&A transaction today in the DOD or federal marketplace? What are the things that you're seeing that are stopping people from going forward?
I think what is sometimes hard for a seller of a business to grasp is about 95% of the sale process is some form of due diligence the buyer is doing on the acquisition target. So
right.
due diligence is not easy. You need to be, as a seller, incredibly prepared to go through that process. And so the impediment is really, you know, surviving the due diligence process. The biggest thing we're seeing right now is companies, the penalty for missing your numbers kind of during the sale process. I think the best example to use, if you look at publicly traded companies who have to report every quarter,
right.
When a company misses its numbers, as they say in Wall Street, they're usually punished from a stock price or valuation perspective. A private company is not immune to that. It's
sure.
just not as visible, but it's certainly visible to the buyer. So we are seeing buyers, you know, fixate on the numbers during performance. So if there was ever a time to under promise and over deliver, it's when you're going through the sale of your business.
So make sure you really understand what you're projecting, how you're projecting it, and make sure that you can hit those numbers, because if you don't, you may not have any offers at the doorstep.
Well, yeah, or you know, you may have had good offers that you lose
as a result of them
losing faith in the business, and it's compounded by this tight budget environment where buyers are fixating on understanding the stability of the business they're looking to acquire.
We're running short of time. What's the most important advice you can give to a company that is operating in today's defense and government services sector?
I think the thing is, you know, whether you're going to sell your business today or in the future, it's all about focusing on building value, doing the right things, doing the fundamentals, and I think the rest will take care of itself. If you focus on building long-term value, then your business will be well positioned when you're ready to engage in a merger and acquisition transaction.
That's good advice. We're talking with John Allen, who is the founder of Bluestone Capital Partners. John, if people want to get in touch with you to find out more about the services that you offer, as well as on the private equity side, as well as merger and acquisition counseling, how do they get in touch with you?
I think the best way to do is look us up on the web, bluestonecapitalpartners.com. You can also, you know, reach me directly at 703-462-5601. And we're always happy and willing to talk to people and share our views on the marketplace.
And thanks for coming back on Blueprint for Wealth. I know that we're going to be talking again soon about the merger and acquisition market for government contractors.
Thank you for having me. And I guess since this will be on or around Thanksgiving, happy Thanksgiving to everybody.
Happy Thanksgiving. Happy Thanksgiving to all of you. And by the way, listen to Blueprint for Wealth every week here on WFED at 10 a.m. and visit our blog at blueprintforwealth.org. Thanks for listening. Have a great week.
You've been listening to Wayne Zell and Blueprint for Wealth. Wayne will be back next Saturday morning at 10 a.m. with your Blueprint for Wealth right here on 1500 a.m. WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a
a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or